Welcome to the last lecture. And so it will be about something completely different. It will have only very little to do with statistical physics. It's more about thermodynamics. And so as a bonus lecture for you today, I would like to discuss black hole thermodynamics. So bonus lecture. It's really a bonus, so you are not required to, you know, study this for your interview. It's just, you know, just for your fun. Black hole thermodynamics. Okay, and so let me start with a motivation. Let me start with something which you already know quite well, and that's the Schwarzschild metric. So the motivation, let's discuss the Schwarzschild solution. We know it describes a black hole, and the geometry takes very simple form. So ds square is minus f dt square plus dr square over f plus r square d omega square, where this metric function f is 1 minus 2m over r, where m is some parameter characterizing your black hole. So this is 2m over r. And then this d omega square is just a metric element on the sphere. So d omega square is just sine squared, well, d theta square plus sine squared theta d phi square. Okay, so this has been derived as a very privileged solution in your relativity course. It's a spherically symmetric solution describing a geometry outside of the star, or equivalently describing a black hole. And then you said, well, the black hole has mass m. Well, as a first step, let me just, you know, try to tell you that this is indeed the case. So you can study what are the properties of this geometry. And so one of these properties will be really what this parameter m is. And what it is the asymptotic mass. And so basically, it's very difficult in general relativity to talk about energies or so energies. You often hear statements like energy is not localized and whatever. So you can really assign a system only asymptotic energy or something like that. And the connection with this asymptotic energy and m comes from the Noether's theorem. So you know that by Noether's theorem, if you have symmetry, then there is an associated conserved quantity. And of course, you know that in general relativity, the symmetries are described by Killing fields. So they really tell you, you know, what are the isometries of your spacetime, what are the symmetries of your spacetime. And so the symmetry is described by a Killing field. Which of course satisfies some equation, nabla mu xi nu plus nabla nu xi mu equals to zero. And so whenever you can find a solution of this equation, you have symmetry present in your spacetime. And so in particular, you study this geometry, and there is lots of symmetries here. And so the most important for us is that the metric is static. It's time independent. And of course, you know, whenever you have something time independent, there will be conserved energy. Okay, so we have that. So specifically, we have xi, which I'll denote k, and it's just the Killing vector dt. So if I move along the time direction, then you know, nothing changes, everything is time independent, and so I have this Killing field present in my spacetime. And there's no surprise that to this, I'll associate the energy in the spacetime. Energy. Okay, so now to calculate what is really the energy of the total space-time, you haven't done that, and you would need the whole lecture to do it. But you can just believe me, I'll give you a formula for how to, you know, given that I know that this is my Killing vector, how to calculate this energy. And so the energy is given by so-called Komar energy. So Komar energy or mass. And the formula is, well, M mass or energy is given by, and then I'll write it in this form, this 1 over 8 pi, why not? And then you integrate over the sphere as 2, and you send the radius of the sphere to infinity. And of course, it has to do something with this Killing vector here. And so the prescription is the Hodge dual d of k. Okay, so I have Killing vector, I take, well, I lower index, I will have one form, and then I calculate this thing, dk, and then I take Hodge star, and it gives me the energy. Okay, I'm not going to prove this relation, but it's not so unfamiliar as you might think. So for example, if you had electromagnetic field, which was described by vector potential k, then dk would be just the field strength. Right, so F is dA, so that's the field strength of your electromagnetic field. And then if you actually integrated star of F, then from the Maxwell equation, it just gives you the charge by the Gauss theorem. Okay, so this is precisely that. So now we are basically saying this K is like a vector potential, you know, for my thing, and now I integrate star of F, and it gives you the mass. And if you calculate this, then surprise, surprise, it's just equal to that parameter m, which appears in the metric. So basically, this is the proof that whatever you call mass in the space-time, this parameter m is indeed the mass, it's the total energy in your space-time. Another proof would be what you have done with Neil, is that you compared with whatever you know from Newton. And so you know that, you know, whatever stands here is like a Newtonian potential, and you compare with whatever you know there. But of course, you cannot really do it for black holes, because black holes do not exist in Einstein gravity, in Newton's gravity. So yeah, for star it's okay, but for black holes this wouldn't be okay. But yeah, this is the prescription how to calculate the mass. Okay, so we have calculated first characteristic of this thing. Second thing is that, you know, how big the black hole is. So black hole horizon, hole horizon. So you know that the black hole horizon is located exactly where your metric function breaks down, where your metric breaks down. So F of R equals to 0. So, and that will happen for some R equal to R plus. And this is equal to 2m. Okay, so that's where your border, that's where your black hole is truly located. Okay, so you can think about the black hole as something which has the radius R plus equals to 2m, and this is my boundary of the black hole. And it's called black hole horizon. So by the way, the black hole is called black because this is a surface of infinite, and now I never know, blue shift or redshift, I don't know. So anyway, if you are on the horizon and you send signals up to any distance r, so you have an observer here sitting at any distance r, then no matter with which frequency you start, this observer will never see it. Okay, so it will, you know, everything will basically be so redshifted that it will never reach the observer. It's an infinite, this is a surface of infinite redshift. So that's why the black hole is black, because it cannot emit anything to you. And there's a simple calculation showing that in the lecture notes. Okay, so nu r over nu on the horizon actually goes to 0. So we have, so r equal to r plus is a surface of infinite, and now I never know how to call it, but let's say redshift. Is that correct, or should it be blue shift? I never know. Well, anyway, so what it means is that it never reaches another thing. So this is all you know so far. Okay, so we have the black hole horizon, and it's located at this radius. And the radius, of course, is related to the mass of the black hole by 2m. Okay, so far, everything is trivial. So now a new concept is that of surface gravity. I don't know if you've seen that. Surface gravity. It's basically another characteristic of the horizon, if you want. And so this is a relatively complicated concept, and I don't want really to go into many details, so I'll just give you a definition, and then I'll tell you what it is approximately, about what is really interesting is you know, what it is equal to. Okay, so you can show that this black hole horizon is so-called killing horizon. Again, you are not killing anybody, but rather is this famous Pearson killing. So what it means is that it's a null surface. So if you take a null cone, you know, the horizon is in fact lying in the null cone, and it's generated by this vector k, which is d over dt. It's our time-like killing vector. And because it's null, the k square is equal to zero on the horizon. So it's a null surface generated by a killing field k d over dt. That means that the tangent vector to my null surface, to my horizon, is this dt killing vector. Okay, so that's fine. So why is this interesting? Is that you can show that whenever this happens, whenever you have a null vector in your spacetime, which generates this null surface, that actually this vector will also be geodesic. Okay, so what you can show is that this vector is geodesic, meaning that it satisfies geodesic equation. Okay, so you can show that k mu, nabla mu, and then k nu, and then surprise, surprise, you have seen the geodesic equation that this is equal to zero. Okay, well, that's one possibility. But that actually requires that you have affine parametrization of your geodesic, that you choose, you know, good parameter which goes along the geodesic. More generally, this will still be a geodesic if it's proportional to k nu. Okay, so let me write this constant of proportionality as kappa, and then k nu. And so this means it's still geodesic. So whatever, you know, whenever this is true, then you have geodesic. Okay, but what this kappa measures is basically how bad your parameter is, with which you parameterize your killing vector. Okay, so this kappa. It's basically, well, so in this case, it's called surface gravity. But basically what it describes, you know, how badly parameterized your killing vector is. Okay, so choosing dt, yeah, you get something which is non-trivial, and that's what you call this surface gravity. Okay, so that's the formal definition. Of course, you want to calculate both sides on the horizon. Okay, so yeah, definition. So now what it is really? Well, it's nothing else. You can think about the surface gravity as really, you know, how strong the gravity is on the black hole horizon. So what is the acceleration you need to provide? What is the force you need to provide to make something static on the horizon? Okay, so by the way, from this definition, can be shown that this kappa for any spherically symmetric spacetime of that form minus fdt square plus dr square over f plus r square d omega square can be shown that this is just given by f prime. So you take the derivative of f with respect to r, evaluate it at r plus on the horizon, and divide by 4 pi. Okay, so if you do it for our thing, well, if I differentiate f, I get 2m over r square, 2m over R square, and then 4 pi is here. Is that correct? You never differentiate in public. Probably true. Is that true? Okay, and then you have to evaluate that at R equal to R plus. Very good. So now I want to write it as a function of R plus only, or as a function of M only. So you are using, so this is equal to M over 2 pi R plus square, of course. And then you either choose to set M equal to 2R plus, or you choose R plus equals to M. And so you get 1 over 4M. Is that correct? Probably not correct. M is 2R. That doesn't work. Oh, maybe it does. And then 1 over 2R plus. 2R plus. That's also not correct. Oh, no. Can you calculate it? 2 pi R plus. Is that correct? So if I have 2R plus, then 2 pi R plus, that's probably fine. And this one, if I'm using R plus, is equal to 2M. And I have 4M. So this is probably 8 pi M. No. What is it? 8 pi M? Interesting. Very good. Okay, so this is what it is. So now if you look at, this can't be true. 2M over R square. Now I know what's not true. Very good. So, very good. What should be here is actually 2. So then I have to multiply. So there's 2 here. And then it's 1 over. Sorry for that. So there's a mistake in my notes. So anyway, what should be here is 1 over 4m and 1 over 2r plus. Okay? I'm sorry for that. Very good. So if you look at this kappa here, for example, look at this expression 1 over 4m. That's something you know from Newton's gravity. Okay? So you know, compare to Newton. So namely, you want to calculate what is the gravitational acceleration, you know, if you had normal Newtonian gravity on a star at the radius 2r plus, okay, at the distance 2r plus. So you know that the gravitational acceleration in Newton is just mass over the distance square. So it's mass, and now I calculate the distance is just, I take just r plus square. And then if you put instead of r plus equals to 2m, well, surprise, surprise, you get 1 over 4m. So it seems like that the surface gravity really describes a Newtonian acceleration on the black hole horizon. Okay, so this is, of course, a coincidence. But basically, it is what it is. So coincidence. But you can sort of think of the surface gravity of this kappa here as, you know, how big the acceleration is on the horizon. Okay, so this is completely incorrect picture, but let's live with it. So what it is actually is the acceleration I have to provide at infinity. So let's say I want to hold a particle on the black hole horizon. If I am exactly at the black hole horizon, the actual force I have to keep the particle there is actually infinite. But if I go away and I go all the way to infinity and I have some very, very long string, which you know, where I keep my particles through the string, then it's exactly the force or acceleration I have to apply at infinity. So that's what kappa truly is. So it's the force applied at infinity to hold objects on the horizon. Okay, but anyway, so we can be happy with saying, yeah, this is something like an acceleration. Okay, so the last quantity you have to calculate is the area of the horizon. So horizon area. Well, it's very simple to calculate. So you are interested basically at instant time and instant radius are equal to r plus. So you have dr equal to 0 because r is equal to r plus. And also, you can calculate it as t equal to constant. So dt equals to 0. So now your metric becomes, so ds square just becomes d gamma square, which is the metric on the horizon. And you know, plugging what that dt is equal to 0 and dr equals to 0 and r equals to r plus, you are just getting r plus square d omega square. So this is your metric on the horizon. And then in order to calculate, you know, the area, you just take a determinant of the metric, take a square root of that, and that's your area. So area is just an integral of determinant of this metric gamma, and then of course d theta d phi. Well, determinant is just r plus square sine theta. So this is r plus square sine theta d phi. Well, it's just an integration over angle. And so the full angle is 4 pi. So there's no surprise, this is 4 pi r plus square. OK. So this is what your area of the horizon is. And now comes an interesting observation. So for some stupid reason, you may start playing with these quantities which you calculated here. And in particular, you may start, you know, differentiating them for no reason whatsoever. So the observation is, that if I calculate the differential of m, well, m is r plus over 2. So this is dr plus over 2. Dr plus over 2. If I calculate the differential of a, dA, well, it's just 8 pi r plus dr plus. And then if I play with kappa as well, then you find an interesting relation. You find that dm equals to kappa over 2 pi. That's the 2 pi I was screwing up. And then dA over 4. OK. So we can check that easily. So kappa is 1 over 4m, and dA is whatever that. And so you can check that this is indeed true. OK, so this is what you find just by playing with all these characteristics of the Schwarzschild solution. OK, and so this observation, this little observation, was the origin of black hole thermodynamics, if you want. But so you know what it has to do with thermodynamics? Of course, nothing at this point. And so indeed, historically, people first thought, well, this is some, well, this, well, you get some laws, which are the laws of black hole mechanics. It has nothing to do with thermodynamics. It's just, you know, playing with some properties of the black holes and comparing whatever you see on the left-hand side and whatever you see on the right-hand side. So part two will be black hole mechanics. So if motivation was part one, and part two is black hole mechanics. And then there were these three famous gentlemen, Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking, in 73, so 1973. They basically shown that, you know, using just the geometry and just the properties of black holes, you can show the following four laws of black hole mechanics. So four laws formulated. So Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking formulated four laws of black hole mechanics. And so these are four more general black holes, of course, than the Schwarzschild black hole. So more generally, your black hole can rotate. It can have some, you know, angular momentum. It can have some charge and so on. So, you know, for generally rotating and charged black hole, you can show the following. So the zeroth law is that the surface gravity is constant on the horizon. of a generic black hole. Okay, so for Schwarzschild, we just have shown that it's equal to 1 over 4 m. Of course, m is a constant, so you know it has the same value everywhere on the horizon, no matter where I am. And so this will be true more generally. And of course, this very, very much reminds you what happens with the temperature. So if you say, well, the temperature of a body in thermal equilibrium is actually constant, right? So then you have the first law. And so what they've shown is that you have dm precisely as we derived here. So kappa over 2 pi dA over 4. And then you can have some work terms. So if your black hole has rotation, then you have the angular momentum times the angular velocity of the horizon. And then plus, if it's charged, then this is the charge, and this is the corresponding electrostatic potential. And so these are the work terms, you know, if they are present, you know, in your black hole spacetime. But the first term is exactly the same one. Okay, and so they show that this is true. Again, you know, I have to, so I showed you how to calculate m. So you probably know how to calculate q. It's just a Gauss theorem in your spacetime. So then to calculate angular momentum is more problematic. But basically, from what I told you, it's obvious that I want to connect it somehow to my Killing vectors in the spacetime. And the thing which corresponds to angular momentum is, of course, the rotational Killing vector. So if I actually took that formula for m and replaced k with d over d phi Killing vector, then I would get something like angular momentum. It's usually normalized differently. So first of all, the sign is different, as always, because we have minus sign for time-like Killing vectors and so on. But it's basically what angular momentum is. So you would calculate that thing by Komar integration as well. OK, so that's the first law. Now I'm missing, So the lecture notes again screwed up. Sorry for that. So the second law tells you that classically, you can show that the area of the horizon never decreases. So no matter what you do, you know, the black hole swallows stuff and never, you know, emits anything, and it's getting bigger and bigger. Okay, so no matter what happens, black hole is getting bigger, so its area is getting bigger.
What is the origin of the work terms?
Of the work terms? Well, you can simply extract some rotational energy of the black hole. So if the black hole, for example, rotates, you know, there is some energy associated with it, and yeah, it enters the first law as well.
And the Q is there.
Is the electromagnetic. So if I have,
So it is infinitesimal charge, right?
Thanks. So the first time is angular momentum, the second one is the charge state. Okay, and so finally, so this looks like that the entropy cannot decrease, right? So it's similar to the and finally, the third law is, well, impossible to reduce kappa to zero in a finite number of steps. And that precisely corresponds to your third law of thermodynamics, that it's impossible to reduce the temperature to absolute zero in a finite number of steps. Okay, so these are the four laws of black hole mechanics, and you know they have nothing to do with thermodynamics. You are just using geometric properties of your black holes. You are just using Einstein equations. You are using other things, But there's no connections whatsoever with thermodynamics. But of course, the analogy is quite striking, right? So it seems that there might be some connection with your laws of thermodynamics. And so in particular, what would you like to do? Would like to compare, with thermodynamics, would like to compare to laws of thermodynamics. And in particular, what you would like to do is that your first law, you would like to compare, so in particular, DE equals to TDS plus work terms. You would like to compare to your first law of black hole mechanics. But of course, in order to do that, well, so the left-hand side is fine. So M describes the total energy in your space-time. So it is basically the same quantity. It is E, if you want. So the left-hand side is OK. But the right-hand side, so you have kappa is the surface gravity. So we would have to, if you want to do this, then the temperature would have to be proportional to the surface gravity. And the area of the black hole would have to be proportional to the entropy. OK? But of course, this is a completely stupid thing to do, because you know that black holes don't have any temperature. They just swallow things. So if they just swallow things, they don't emit anything. They cannot have any temperature. So this is crazy. And you know, it cannot be solved. If you want, the black hole is an ultimate sponge, and you cannot extract, you know, it doesn't radiate anything away. It just swallows. OK, so this was 73. And then I don't know exactly when, but I think it's probably 73 and 74. Well, Bekenstein anyway imposed, well, he said, well, no matter that I'm crazy, but I can really associate this with thermodynamics. So it was this crucial idea due to Wheeler, who was his supervisor. So Wheeler's cup of tea. And so basically, what Wheeler asked Bekenstein to do for his PhD thesis is he asked, well, what happens if I have, you know, hot cup of tea and I throw it into the black hole? Okay, so first of all, you know, what happens with the temperature? Am I heating the black hole slightly, or what's happening there? And what's happening with the entropy? So of course, the cup of tea had some entropy. Now it's swallowed by the black hole. So where did the entropy go? You know, what happened there? And so Bekenstein analyzed this, of course, not practically, but it's just some thought experiments. And based on these thought experiments, he actually concluded that, you know, the entropy of the cup had to change some property of the black hole, and that property was precisely the area. So he showed that basically the entropy is proportional to the area. Okay, some thought experiments. And it was a result of his thesis. And of course, people thought it's crazy, because that would mean, really, you know, can I assign a finite temperature to the black hole? That was the question. And if not, then of course, you know, this is very, very vague and very strange. Okay? So now, you know, based on this, actually, you know, some people thought it is completely crazy, and some people like Hawking actually tried to prove that kappa is proportional to temperature. And so Hawking, probably 74 or 75, I don't remember. So he basically, so there was this new developed subject of quantum field theory in curved space. And so he used that, and he actually calculated what happens if you send some scalar field onto your black hole, and then you wait long enough to see what happens with the scalar field. Of course, the scalar field scatters off the black hole, but as it scatters, what he calculated is that it actually gets magnified. So there is some, you know, stimulated emission of scalar field from the black hole. And so he said, well, the thing which I am getting extra is an extra radiation I am getting from the black hole. And that's what is called Hawking radiation. OK, so using QFT in curved space, you will have two lecture introduction to QFT in curved space in the cosmology course. But it's not probably enough to calculate anything anyway. okay. And so what he showed is that, you know, based on this, the black holes actually radiate black holes radiate particles as black body, at the temperature T. And now so I was using geometric units so far, so everything was equal to 1, h bar, c, and g, and everything. So now let me restore just for this one formula here. So there is h bar, so it's really quantum mechanical thing. And then the surface gravity kappa, and then 2 pi, and the Boltzmann constant. So that's the temperature which you calculated for the black hole. And of course, if you have that, you can also fix that proportionality constant for the entropy. And so the entropy is then A over 4 h bar and then g newton. OK, so this was the result of Hawking's calculation. And although some people still don't believe his derivation, so for example, Bill Unruh never accepted this derivation. And the reason is that basically you are using this, you know, QFT in curved space, which is like low energy effective theory, if you want. But you are calculating for the modes which are infinitely blue shifted close to the horizon. So actually the energy is close to the horizon of the field is huge, because everything gets blue shifted as we go to the horizon. And so he was saying, yeah, so you have calculated something, but definitely, you know, outside of the domain of validity of your theory. But then it was shown sort of later that you can introduce some cutoff for these, you know, the modes, how big the momenta of the modes get, and you don't really need to you know, and the result is independent of the cutoff. So yeah, so there's still criticism of Hawking's derivation, but what is actually interesting is that other completely different methods. Different methods, and there is many of them, and they have nothing to do with Hawking's derivation, give the same result. And here I mean, you know, really the theories which sort of are candidates for quantum gravity theory, like string theory, you can reproduce these things, at least in special cases. In loop quantum gravity, you can reproduce these in special cases. You can use the Euclidean path integral, and you reproduce exactly this temperature and exactly that entropy, and so on. So it seems that although, you know, the derivation is very untrustable and whatever, the result is actually correct. Okay, questions?
Comment some more on that blue shift near the horizon and why it wouldn't work.
Well, I would rather not to. But really, you know, it's very simple. So you know, you send scalar field, and the scalar field, you know, sort of, you know, what is really important is that the scalar field crosses close to the horizon. So it's, you know, some scalar field, of course, goes inside a black hole, and some scalar field is scattered off the black hole. So it's, you know, it comes to the black hole and then goes back to infinity. And so what really is important is that you get very, very close to the horizon so that you stimulate the emission of you know, the Hawking radiation in some sense. So you are really, really close to the horizon. But you know, no matter which frequency I start here, as I go closer to the horizon, the frequency increases, right? So really, if I'm, you know, scratching the surface of the black hole, my frequency is infinite. Okay, so it's an infinite blue shift, red shift thing. Okay, and so of course, you know, that, you know, because you have infinite frequency, you know, that means that there should be some back reaction, right? So you have infinite energy, if you want, and so there must be some back reaction onto the black hole, and so your approximation of QFT in curved space is not good enough, because now you have so big energies that you cannot trust that, right? And so that was the problem which Bill Unruh had from the very beginning with Hawking's derivation. And he's right. Yeah, that's definitely a problem. Other questions? Yeah.
Those laws of black hole mechanics, like, where did they come from? They look like they were made to fit in the thermodynamics. So, like, they look too similar. Like, were they inspired on them, like, on purpose? Or
well, of course, yeah. So yeah, people are trying to, you know, prove things, you know, finding the analogy with this thermodynamics, if you want. But yeah, so they are just, you know, purely geometric results. So they have nothing to do with thermodynamics whatsoever. I'm just using, you know, some, you know, basically the techniques of general relativity, and you can show that this will be true for basically very generic black hole. So yeah, so I'm, you know, really talking about the geometry. I'm talking about getting fields, generating my horizon, calculating the surface gravity geometrically, and so on. So it's nothing to do with temperature, or nothing to do with anything else.
But it can be derived from that. It's not something that you assume that's, you
know. No. This was derived. So when you discuss thermodynamics, the laws of thermodynamics were actually, you know, postulated in some sense. So here you can really derive these things as results of a calculation. Yeah. Was another? Yeah.
Okay. So the third law, kappa, goes to zero in a finite number of steps. So what are steps there?
Well, I don't know. So. That's always sneaky, first law, right? So, third law. So, I try to motivate that you cannot go to absolute zero if you go on a certain path. So, they have taken some certain path how you could reduce the surface gravity. For example, you are trying to make your black hole more and more extremal. So, for example, so let's say I have a charged black hole, and so, you know, the bigger the charge is, smaller kappa is. So, now I start throwing inside charges. And see, you know, what's happening with kappa, and you will see that you cannot actually, you know, approach kappa equal to zero in a finite number of steps, no matter what you do. Yeah. So this is, yeah, but it's like a demonstration. I don't know if there is a general proof of that, but you know, you can always take an example and you can try to make your black hole extremal and reduce your surface gravity to zero, but yeah, you will not succeed. And there was one more question.
Yeah. So. In the context of holography, you usually have some black hole space-time that's dual to a quantum field theory.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if these type of equations are exactly dual to some thermodynamic equations in the quantum field theory. No?
Yes. The answer is yes. But of course, you have well-established holography only for ADS black holes.
Yeah.
So in that case, yes, you can map whatever those laws are to laws of what happens to your CFT on the boundary. But for asymptotically flat, some people believe, yes, you can still do it. But of course, your correspondence is not well established, if you want. All right, so now this was all thermodynamics. So now I want to show you some, you know, I'm not going to show you Hawking's derivation of this temperature result, because we would need QFT in curved space. But there is a very, very sneaky way how to obtain the result very, very quickly. And so let me show you that sneaky way. But again, it's not something which is, you know, commonly accepted. Many people do accept that. But again, there are some flaws with this derivation. So there is a Euclidean sneaky trick. And so it comes from the observation, which you will see not next week, but in your first week of QFT2, is that whenever your system has temperature, your Green's functions are actually periodic in imaginary time. Okay, so thermal Green function, and it will be shown by Francois, you know, the first week of your QFT2. Thermal Green functions have periodicity in imaginary time. So what do you mean by imaginary time is that instead of t, you use a new quantity I tau, which is basically what Dennis yesterday showed. So he was discussing basically this tau here. But anyway, so you take your normal time and you take i times tau time and you get tau. So that's your imaginary time. And so when you do that, your Green's function satisfies the following property. If it's a thermal Green's function, it satisfies that g of tau is equal to G tau plus beta, where beta is precisely related to your temperature. So this is your beta as we know it. Okay, so we can show that this will be true. And in other, you can reverse the logic and you say, if I have if I have green functions which satisfy this property, well, they must describe a thermal state. Okay, and so now what you can actually show is that if you study some fields in the vicinity of your black hole, their green functions will have exactly this property. So they behave like if they were in a thermal bath. So green functions of various fields, for example, scalar field. So green functions of fields in the vicinity of the black hole, vicinity of black hole, obey this property. Again, in a while, I'll not show that, just you have to believe me here, that if you calculate the Green's function for, let's say, scalar field or Dirac field, well, Dirac field is complicated, but electromagnetic field, yeah?
Is this condition the KMS condition?
Is it, which condition?
For the Green's function?
So G is the Green function,
yes.
And
if this is the KMS condition for
KMS,
for if you got a thermodynamic or the thermal system, then for the Green's function, you've got a certain condition.
So that must be that, yes. That must be that. Okay, so this is true. So now, of course, the question is, what happens with the, so this is well-established physics. So people agree on all that. So that means, like, really, the fields behave like if they were in thermal baths in the vicinity of the black hole. And that's fine. And, there is no dispute about this. So behave as in thermal baths. Okay, but what happens to what happens to gravitational field itself? That's the question. And so this is not so well established. And so there was this huge debate between Penrose and Hawking. Where Penrose was saying, well, Hawking was saying, whatever I do now is well established and it's fine. And Penrose was saying, well, this is complete bollocks and it doesn't make any sense whatsoever from the very beginning to the very end. And you just get the right result by mere luck or I don't know. So this is what I'm going to now do. So that's two. So let's consider Schwarzschild extended to the Euclidean time, so it's called Euclideanized. Schwarzschild. So which means that I just take my metric for the Schwarzschild geometry and I extend time to imaginary time. Okay? So then you are getting that your metric now, ds Euclideanized square is just, well, dt square now becomes I square d tau square. So becomes, I hope the I is correct. So it becomes f d tau square plus dr square over f plus r square d omega square. Okay, so this is your Euclideanized Schwarzschild geometry. I just changed t to I tau, and this is what you are getting. So you are getting plus here instead of original minus. Okay, so that's the first thing to do. What am I doing?
So now what I try to explain is that what really matters for the derivation is, you know, if you are close to the horizon. So that's, you know, where Hawking had to calculate his, you know, emission is close to the horizon. So we can concentrate on the vicinity of the horizon. So near horizon, you can expand your metric function. So your metric function f of r becomes f of r plus, I'm doing the Taylor expansion in, you know, around r minus r plus r minus r plus, and then f prime at r plus, and plus other terms. Okay, so let me call this guy delta r. So now if I didn't screw up the definition of kappa, this is just 2 kappa. The surface gravity is f prime over 2. Okay. And of course, this guy is equal to 0 because we are on the horizon, and that's our condition for the horizon. Okay, so this is nothing else than 2 kappa delta r. Okay, so this is how your metric function looks in the vicinity of the horizon, and that's all you need to know for deriving the Hawking thing. Okay, so let me plug it to the geometry. So now the SE square is just 2 kappa delta r d tau square, and then dr square 2 kappa delta r, and then plus the spherical part, which is not interesting. Okay, so now the great idea is to look at this expression here. And you see that everything here depends only on r coordinate, okay? So you can introduce a new coordinate rho, just saying that this guy is equal to d rho square. So this is d rho square, which of course means that d rho is dr over square root of 2 kappa delta r. Now, you remember that r, delta r is just r minus r plus, so delta r is linear in r. And so, surprise, you can actually integrate this thing. So you can really write what rho is as a function of r, or r as a function of rho, and then you can plug it for delta r. So this is, so it gives you that delta r is kappa over 2, and then rho square, by integrating this relation here. Okay, just do it yourself. Because I screwed up the differentiation 1 over r, I'm not going to integrate 1 over r, square root of 1 over r, that would be too complicated. So what it means is that you are getting that your d s e square, well, it's now 2 kappa, and delta r is just kappa over 2, and then rho square, d tau square, and then plus d rho square. This is how we define rho. Okay, so this simplifies 2 cancel, and you have this is equal to kappa square, and let me write it d tau square, and then rho square, and plus d rho square. Okay, so by the way, just notice that if we are exactly on the horizon, that means r equals to r plus. That means delta r equals to 0. Okay, so if delta r equals to 0, then rho is equal to 0. So where the original horizon was corresponds to my new coordinate rho equal to 0. Okay, so the horizon corresponds to rho equal to 0. Okay, not just something. And so now if you are looking at this Euclidean metric here, then you have a term, d rho square, and then you have rho square times something. So if that's something I call deep psi square, then it looks like I have just polar coordinates, you know, around the origin. Okay, so I define this to be rho square deep psi square plus d rho square, where this psi is just kappa times tau, right? And then this would be just polar coordinates. Polar coordinates. So describing, you know, what happens around rho equal to zero. But now is this beauty here. So these are really polar coordinates if and only if the coordinates have the right ranges. So in particular, if rho goes from zero to infinity, okay, well, it does in our case, and if psi goes from zero to 2 pi. Because if psi doesn't go from zero to 2 pi, you get a conical singularity in the origin. If you try to twist something and you don't go 2 pi, you get this spike here, right? So then I would have less than 2 pi would be like that, and like that would be if I have greater than 2 pi. So I require that regularity in the origin, requires that psi is identified as 2 pi. Otherwise, if I don't do that, I have a conical singularity in the origin. Okay, so if this is not true, then I'm screwed up. So why do I require regularity in the origin? So remember, the origin is just the black hole horizon. Okay, but you of course know from your relativity course that on the black hole horizon there is really no true singularity for Schwarzschild geometry. What is really there, you know, is that some coordinate system breaks down, but there is no true singularity. I can you know, change coordinates and my black hole horizon will be perfectly regular. So basically, what you require is that yes, your horizon is still regular, but now in this, you know, Euclidean version.
Why wouldn't these just be bad coordinates? Just like
they could be, but you know, well, this, you know, these are nice coordinates if you identify psi. So otherwise, if you don't identify psi, you have to say, yeah, I have to, yeah, the origin. But this is basically, these coordinates would break down only at that one point. Yeah, well, whatever. So I want regularity, and so this is what is usually imposed. Okay. So now what that means, so if psi has a periodicity of 2 pi, so psi has a periodicity 2 pi, but psi is given by kappa times tau. Okay, so that means that actually tau has a periodicity. So tau has a periodicity tau plus 2 over kappa. 2 pi over kappa. Is that right? It must be right, 2 pi over kappa. Again, mistake in my notes, sorry for that. So your imaginary time of your Schwarzschildian geometry is periodic. And it's periodic with period beta, which is given by 2 pi over kappa. But that means your space-time actually has a temperature. And the temperature is 1 over beta. So from here, you're saying that the temperature is 1 over beta, which is kappa over 2 pi, which is the Hawking result if I restore this h bar and kb. Okay, so this is the sneaky way how to derive that your spacetime actually has, the black hole has, temperature kappa over 2 pi. Questions? Okay, so
This was great, but you can actually do even better than that. You can actually push this Euclidean technique even further. And so the way how you do that is that you, so by the way, okay, so this just gives you 1 over 8 pi m for Schwarzschild if you pluck whatever that thing is there. Okay, by the way, how your geometry now looks like. So your geometry, the Euclidean geometry, is given by this, you know, polar coordinates here. And then there's this also spherical part. So your Schwarzschild geometry, so Euclidean, Schwarzschild, just looks like a cigar. So here is your r equal to 2m, r equal to 2m, or rho equal to 0. And then I have normal polar coordinates around this point here. So I'm living on the surface of the cigar. So I'm living here. And so this is my time, periodic time, plus beta, as I go around this thing. Okay, and this is my coordinate r, if you want. So now you are really living on the surface of the cigar. And so at each point on the surface, you're still hiding your sphere. You're still hiding your S2 there. Okay, so this is, you know, so what is this? It's really like, you know, a plane, if you want. It's likely R2. But the problem is that one of the coordinates is compactified. Okay, so the tau doesn't go from minus infinity to infinity, but it's, you know, it's periodic with period beta. So I have to put it around. Okay. Okay. So this is what it is. It's a cigar. Okay. So now, the final and very, you know, convincing argument is that you can not only recover the temperature by this thing, but you can also recover the entropy. And so that's why people, you know, like this Euclidean trick. So now going further, you can actually calculate what the partition function is. So in our case, it will be an integral over all possible metrics, and then e to minus Euclideanized action. However, in the WKB approximation, you just know that this is just equal to e to minus s Euclideanized evaluated at classical solutions of your action. Okay, so this is just whatever you know from classical mechanics. So I'm just, you know, taking the settle point, if you want. And so this must be true. And of course, your G classical is just whatever the geometry we are talking about here. So this is just your Schwarzschild, classical Schwarzschild, no matter what this path integral is. Okay. And so the only thing which you need to know is what is this Euclidean action for gravity. Okay. So what it is, it's very simple. It consists of two parts. So unfortunately, Neil didn't do that. But some of you definitely know. So it consists of the Einstein-Hilbert action, which was known already in 1915, actually before the Einstein knew his equations, was formulated by Hilbert. And so this is just an integral b4 of x, square root of g, and then the Ricci scalar. There's nothing else you can write down than the Ricci scalar if you want in the first approximation, and then g Newton. So that's your Einstein-Hilbert. But this is not well-defined variational principle. Because if you have some boundary, on that boundary, you would have to fix what delta g is a constant. The variation of metric is constant, but also the variation of the derivative of the metric is constant. OK, so that is a problem if you have variational principle on a compact manifold. And so to kill these unwanted terms on the boundary, you have to add one more term. So this is over my manifold omega. And then you have the boundary term, which kills these unwanted terms. And it's d3x
square root of the three metric now, and extrinsic curvature doesn't matter what it is, and then G Newton again. So this is Einstein-Hilbert, and this is Gibbons Hawking term. And so you will see this much more explicitly in your gravitational physics course with Ruth Gregory after Christmas. But you know, just believe me, to have well-posed variational principle for Einstein equations, I have to have these two terms. Okay? And without the second term, the first term, which is usually stated in first courses on GR, your variational principle is not well defined. Okay? And it's precisely the first problem which we had in classical mechanics. Well, what if I add to Lagrangian something which is a total derivative of, you know, L, which depends on Q and Q dot? So now the whole thing depends on Q, Q dot, and Q double dot. So this is precisely what happens here. So this action has actually two derivatives of the metric, and that's why the action principle is not well defined. Okay? So anyway, so you want to calculate this action, and you want to evaluate it on your Schwarzschild solution. Okay? So now if you are staring at the action, what happens with the first term? What do I get when I actually calculate the action for Schwarzschild solution here? Anybody? So Schwarzschild solution, I plug in whatever. What do I get for the action? I calculate the first term.
Zero.
Who said that? Ah, very good. So why is it zero?
Because R is zero.
Very good. So it's a vacuum solution of Einstein equations. So R mean is equal to zero, which means R equals to zero. So this thing actually doesn't give me anything. So for vacuum solutions, the first term always gives you zero. And it's only the second term which contributes to the value of the action. Okay? So. For vacuum solution. R is equal to zero, which means only the second term contributes okay. So now you may think, okay, so very good, so I'll calculate the second term. It gives me something, and I have my partition function. Just take exponential of that, and that's it. So now you calculate that. So let's say, how you do that is that you say, well, I have to cut my Euclidean size sigar at some r equals to big r. And then what you want to, so you basically regularize your thing. So you want your action to be defined on a compact manifold, so you have to cut your manifold somewhere at some radius equal to big R, so you go only to some big R. And then you calculate the action, and then you say, well, I want to take then R goes to infinity. Okay, so that's what you basically want. So take, so impose, if you want cutoff, R equal to R, and then eventually you want, and then this is what you want to do. R goes to infinity. But of course, there's a betrayal, as always, with quantum field theories, is that you get an infinity, right? So actually, if you calculate the action, the second term, and calculate, truncated at some big R, then you get that this thing is proportional to big R. Okay, so if I have something proportional to big R, I send big R to infinity, I have linear divergence in R. Okay, so what you actually have to do is that you have to renormalize, regularize, but you have to also renormalize. And now, so there's a renormalization required. Which is now done much better than in the original thing, but the original was quite intuitive, so let me do the original one. So this is what we want to calculate. We want to calculate the sigar at r equal to r. Okay, and the period here of my time is just tau plus beta. So this is the cigar. And we know that this guy diverges. But of course, this thing here, the fact that it closes here, that I have a black hole horizon sitting here, is only caused by the fact that I have some mass. So the mass present in the space-time causes that your cigar closes there, that I have a black hole horizon, if you want. Okay, so what is natural to do is you want to subtract the flat space. Okay, but of course, the flat space is the same temperature. So how you do that is that you subtract just a cylinder. It's the same thing, tau plus beta. So this is a flat space. Okay, and if you do that, it exactly cancels the divergence at big R. Okay, and so what you get after you do this renormalization, which is sort of quite intuitive, you know, this thing, you know, the fact that it closes is caused by M. So if I want to really extract the information about the black hole, which is encoded in this M, I just subtract the flat space with the right periodicity. Okay, and so what you get is that S E, which is now renormalized, is just SE of cigar minus SE of flat. And you get finite, beautiful result that is equal to beta M over 2. So beta is the periodicity, which is given by the temperature 1 over T. And M is the mass. So now you get something which really depends on the mass, which causes your thing to curve. OK, so that's your Euclidean action. Of course, the partition function is now that is just E to minus this thing, beta M over 2. That's your partition function. Once you have the partition function, you can calculate the free energy. So the free energy is just minus T logarithm of z, okay, logarithm of z, z is just exponential, it's just the exponent, and so this is, and beta is 1 over t, so this is just m over 2. Okay, so that's your free energy for your Schwarzschild spacetime. And so now you can use the thermodynamics, again, as we did many times in this course, so you can calculate, for example, the entropy. So the entropy is minus df over dt. So now remember that the temperature is related to the mass as this thing. So this is what we derived before. Temperature is 1 over 8 pi m. So really this m depends on temperature. So you can write this free energy in terms of the temperature. And so if you do this, you just find that this is equal to pi. Well, OK, it's 1 over 16 pi t squared, which you can rewrite in terms of what r plus is as pi r plus square, which is just area over 4. Okay, so this thing, this Euclidean thing, Euclidean action, partition function calculation, actually gives you the right entropy as well. So this Euclidean trick gives you everything. It's very, very self-consistent. It not only gives you the right temperature for the black hole, but also gives you what the entropy has to be. And so you can justify Bekenstein's result here. Questions to this? I know this is very fast. You will see it again with all the bloody details in the gravitational physics course, this calculation. So you will really calculate, you know, how this action is really calculated. So you will do that for some more complicated black hole, doesn't matter. But you will do this explicitly yourself just wait after Christmas. I'm just giving you the main points, the main ideas, what's going on here. But really, it gives you the right result here. Questions? OK, no questions. So the last thing which is I would like to very briefly discuss is, of course, so now we established, sort of, that the black holes do have temperature, and they irradiate, you know, away particles as if they were a black body at the temperature T. And the temperature T is actually related to the actual mass of the black hole as 1 over m. Okay? So now
because the temperature goes like 1 over m. So the bigger the black hole is, smaller the temperature is, right? So in other words, your evaporation is very, very slow. The temperature is very, very small for large astrophysical black holes. But as the black hole is getting smaller and smaller, the temperature gets bigger and bigger, right? And so in some sense, the evaporation accelerates, right? So the smaller the black hole I have, more it radiates away, and then it gets more, even smaller. Okay, so what you can show, well, so let us ask, you know, how long it takes for the black hole to evaporate. So how long it takes to evaporate black hole completely. Well, and so you know that it radiates like black body. So that means that your standard Stefan Boltzmann law is true for how much energy is radiated away. So you have that dm over dt, which is how much energy it is losing, is proportional to sigma t to the 4. Sigma is the Stefan Boltzmann constant, and times the area, the effective area of the black hole which actually evaporates. Okay, so there'll be some A, which is the effective area. You know, I take the black hole is that area A, and then this temperature here, and so this must be true. So now, of course, what is this proportional to? If I take this area to be really the size of the black hole, the horizon of the black hole, so the area is proportional to R plus square. So it goes like M square. So this area goes like M square. The temperature, on the other hand, goes like 1 over m, each temperature, so 4 times, so 1 over m to the 4. Okay, so this is, of course, there's a minus sign, which is important, is that I'm losing the energy. Okay, so you have m square over m to the 4, so this goes like 1 over m square. Okay, and so you can integrate this relation and get that the time is proportional to m cube. So then really the time it takes is, so okay, time is proportional to m cube from this, if I'm solving this equation here. And you can write it, you can normalize it, well, okay, it's proportional to m cube. And then if you plug all the constants in and whatever, then what you get is actually that the time equals to approximately m over m sun cube times 10 to 71 seconds. Okay, that's a huge time. So if you have a black hole with the mass of the sun, then of course this thing is just one, and it takes 10 to 71 seconds for the black hole to evaporate. That's, I don't know what is the age of the universe, but I guess it's many times bigger than the age of the universe. So you don't really have to be afraid of black holes which are, you know, of solar mass, because if they start evaporating, they will never evaporate, you know, before your eyes. But of course, if you have some tiny black holes, for example, those created in CERN, if you created some by colliding two particles, then they would have teeny tiny mass. And so they would, so this thing would be really, really small, and then they could evaporate in front of your eyes. And this is what people were looking for, actually. So there was this crazy theory, yes, if I have a high extra dimensions, then by colliding two particles in CERN, I can create a black hole, and this black hole would immediately evaporate. And I could see, you know, the bunch of particles evaporating from the black hole, evaporating like black body. Right, so and this was the sign people were looking for, but they haven't observed anything as far as I know. So this would basically tell you that the cross section to create the black hole is smaller than predicted by those theories. So you don't create these black holes, and that imposes some restrictions on how many extra dimensions you can have in your space time. Okay, so there's just that thing, and then finally,
you know, if you have these teeny tiny black holes, or no matter how the black hole is, so there's a theoretical problem. As you start evaporating the black hole, you know, there's something which is called information paradox. Information paradox. Or information problem. And you know, and that is, you know, what happens with information stored in the black hole after it evaporates. Okay, so that's the question. You know, what happens? So you know, when you are forming the black hole, there's lots of information coming in. So, for example, I collapsed an elephant into the black hole, and so I have the information about the elephant that went in. Or I thrown a chair inside the black hole, and so there was an information, you know, that the chair went in. But of course, the black hole, as it evaporates, then only blackbody radiation comes out. So blackbody radiation carries no information whatsoever. The only information is stored in the temperature, and the temperature is stored in mass. So mass doesn't carry any information in some sense, right? So it, you know, everything evaporates uniformly in all directions, exactly the same. No information is coming out, basically. So what happened with the information, you know, as you put it in? So now, if the black hole completely evaporates and no information was carried out, whatever is left there must carry all the information which I put in at the beginning. And of course, there's a big problem with this. And you know, there's you know, many solutions to this paradox, but none of them really works. And so you can read about this in Wikipedia if you want. It's a beautiful, beautiful section in Wikipedia. But it's still an open problem, an open question. So most people agree that, yeah, maybe at some time the information starts coming out. Maybe really the radiation is not exactly as blackbody radiation. There is something else. So there's extra information coming out. But this is usually problematic because it requires huge departure from general relativity. So you know that would basically mean that something very bad happens on the horizon, or the black hole, something like firewalls or whatever. So that's not, you know, the simplest solution. Some people, like usually general relativists, argue, well, so the information is lost, so who cares, right? Of course, people who do quantum theory and, you know, particle physics, they don't like that because they like unitary evolution, and unitary evolution means information is not lost, right? So that would mean as I collapse the black hole, actually, it wouldn't be a unitary evolution in some sense. So you know, people oppose the idea that the information is lost. But it's, you know, it's an interesting open problem, which already is here from, you know, the first early days of Hawking, 74, when he realized that black holes do evaporate, and you know, it's still open problem here and now. So let me finish here, and I take questions. No questions. Well, then this is the end of the course. Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank, as a fellow, to the lecturer. Thank you so much. And or the teacher. Thank you.